68, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'm Jason Ehrenberg for the appellant Stephanie Schweitzer. As the court is aware, the appellant has raised two issues in this case. The first issue is whether the False Claims Act gives the government an unfettered right to dismiss a key TAM action pursuant to a government-proposed settlement agreement, even though the Act explicitly requires courts to first consider the reasonableness of a settlement. The second issue is whether an employee, such as Ms. Schweitzer, whose normal job duties include contract compliance and who is asserting a whistleblower claim under the Act, meets the Act's notice requirement by notifying her employer's senior management that she believes the employer is engaging in fraud under the Act. Now, with regard to the first issue, that issue is one of first impression before this court. The government noted this much during the proceedings below at page 120 of the party's joint appendix, when it noted during a January 20, 2010 hearing in the matter that it hadn't found any case law on point. The court below said as much as well, noting at that same hearing that this court's prior interpretation of the government's ability to dismiss a key TAM suit is, quote, somewhat at odds with the statute's provision for court approval of a settlement.
That's a little different than saying we don't have any law in the circuit.
Explicitly.
Read again to me what you just said.
At page 52 of the joint appendix in the court's decision granting the motion to dismiss, the court noted that this court's prior interpretation of the government's ability to dismiss a key TAM suit.
Stop right there. There is prior case law
pursuant
the government's ability to dismiss a key TAM proceeding.
Right? Pursuant only to section 3730C2A. Mm-hmm. Neither Swift nor Hoyt, the two prior cases that this court has decided involving dismissal of a key TAM suit.
They're not settlement cases, are they?
Exactly. They're not settlement cases. And they did not have, the court did not have reason in those cases.
The government can't dismiss it. It can dismiss it outright.
The government can, under certain circumstances, dismiss outright.
Right. But the government can't get money or give up money to dismiss in a settlement without court approval.
Correct.
But what's the purpose of the hearing in A?
I think the purpose of the hearing, quite frankly, it seems somewhat nonsensical if there's an unfettered right, mm-hmm. but I think the purpose of the hearing, as I understand it, and as I believe this court has stated it, is, and as the Supreme Court has noted, is for the relator to try to convince the government to keep the case going.
Isn't that what telephones are for? Why do you have to have a hearing for that?
As with many statutes, I think there are some things that Congress has included that maybe weren't thought out completely. But I think with regard to the hearing in 37C2B, that serves a very different purpose, and that's a judicial purpose. And it's not just a forum for the relator to try to convince the government to keep the case going.
It's not uncommon for a government agency to bring an action and reach a settlement in a particular matter, particularly I think of all the publicity around the SEC's various actions. And then the court reviewing the terms of the settlement before it allows the government agency to settle. Now, one of the theories that I think the government sponsors here is, well, that's because these are, in the SEC area, for example, it's a consent decree that is enforceable by the court. And oftentimes, my experience has been that those decrees enjoin the private party to comply with the Securities Act in the future, something like that. So one might, and the government, I think, draws the, I'm getting to the question, draws the distinction that here this is not in the nature of a consent decree. But I've read this decree, and it seems like the court is retaining continuous jurisdiction, and also seems to be that in the nature of a judgment here. So even if one accepts the government's distinction, which is not on the face of B, but it seems to not get them where they want to go.
I agree, Your Honor, completely. And I also would like to note that those aren't the only circumstances where a court reviews, quote unquote, a settlement, or where a court has to analyze what is fair and adequate and reasonable before a case is dismissed. And of particular note is Rule 48 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, which explicitly states that the court, the government may not, and the parties may not, dismiss a complaint, an information, or an indictment without court approval. And while...
However, in application, courts have generally, if not explicitly, recognize that the government can dismiss criminal actions even if the court doesn't like the idea. I mean, they could have come before me when I was a trial judge, and I'm not saying that this exactly ever happened, but they could have and said, we're moving to dismiss count X of the indictment. And if I said, no, I'm not going to let you do that, and the government said the government rests on count X,
and
it was gone.
And practically, that may be the case, and essentially that is
practically what, that is the case, counsel.
And that is what the court here did. But that doesn't mean that, as the government has, or as the court below argued, and as OSE argued in their brief, that encroaches upon the realm of the executive. It's common for courts to have some role. It's part of the checks and balances of our federal government. And I don't want to belabor this point, but to argue that Section 37B is unconstitutional because it violates the separation of power, in my mind, is nonsensical, because it's not saying the court is deciding whether or not you can bring a case. It's not saying the court's deciding whether or not you can continue. It's just allowing the court to play a role to make sure that justice is served, just as in the case.
Is it an effort to protect the relator? Is that the...
Exactly. It's not just an effort to protect the relator, but essentially that's the purpose. Just as with Rule 48, when courts, Criminal Rule 48, when courts have analyzed the separation of powers issue, they have found that this is not an encroachment. It's a normal check and balance for the public good, to make sure that justice is served. I'm running out of my time, so I'd like to just note briefly the second issue, unless anyone has more questions about...
It's clear, is it not, that the government could have dismissed this action without court approval? Because there was no responsive pleading, even though it was beyond the 60-day period.
Correct.
The
government...
responsive pleading didn't come until after the court dismissed it.
The response of pleading basically came at the same time in this case. And in our argument, I don't think
Rule 41, if the government had not entered into a settlement of the rules of civil procedure, the government could have come in under SWIFT and just dismissed us.
The government could have come in and intervened in the prior 2.5 years and moved to dismiss, and the government chose not to. And the government recognized as much when it filed its motion to dismiss, by noting that both 37, 30C2A and B were at issue.
So what if the government had a side agreement with the defendant, saying, look, we're going to do such and so, but on the record, all we're going to do is move to dismiss.
Well,
does the court then have to conduct this hearing?
I think, to be fair to the relator and to fulfill Congress's vision and the purpose of the statute, in practice, the government should not do that and cannot do that, because the relators are the ones that are uncovering the fraud. The relators are the ones that are in the best position to protect the government, and that would essentially be throwing the relator under the bus.
So any settlement agreement in this type of action has to be spread before the court, either in camera or on the record. Right?
Under the scheme that Congress created now, yes.
You know, B says may settle, not must settle. B says the government may settle the action.
Correct.
With the defendant, and in that case, you need to get court approval. But does it have to do it that way? Why can't it do what Judge Randolph suggested, a two-step here?
I mean, certainly that the government can do that. However, in this case, the government did not choose to do that.
No, I'm just trying to understand the interplay between A and B.
Quite frankly, I don't know the answer to that. And okay. As with ERISA,
your point is the settlement and the dismissal were part and parcel of the same transaction.
The statute doesn't always reflect brilliant drafting, but I think to ignore the requirement of 3730C2B in this case, under the facts presented here, would be to render, as the court below had suggested, would be to render 3730C2B a dead letter.
That seems to be a problem with the otherwise reasonable looking interpretation, is that it would render a section a dead letter.
Do you have a response to the government? I don't think makes a constitutional separation of powers argument, but the defendant doesn't. What's your response?
And again, I think the response, this takes me back to Rule 48 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. This court, in its Hoyt decision, which followed Swift, noted that there were four bases for its reading of 3730C2A. One was separation of powers. One was the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and Rule 41A. One was the discretion afforded the prosecutor in criminal prosecutions. And here, if you look at the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, which this court invoked in Hoyt as an analysis, as I said, that if there's a separation of powers issue here, why is there not a separation of powers issue when a prosecutor seeks to dismiss an indictment or a complaint or an information and needs court approval? What is any different here than in that circumstance? And while there have been no cases explicitly on point here, looking at C2B.
Well, I can see a difference with respect to indictments. I don't know about complaints or information. The indictment is technically brought by the grand jury, not the prosecutor. So you've got a third party involved in that.
But the prosecutor has to decide in the first place to bring that before the grand jury. And so essentially, it's showing that Congress has given, that the legislative branch has given the judiciary a proper check.
I hate to take this even further afield, but what do you see as the standard the court is supposed to be applying in that criminal context? I mean, the rule simply says the court is involved. It doesn't say the court has any particular standard, does it?
Right. I think from the cases that I've looked at, looking at those, it's what is just and what is in the public interest.
That's not in the rule itself, though, right?
No, it is not.
Mm-hmm. So, for all we can tell from the rule, it's a pro forma function of the court that's simply there to terminate an action started by the grand jury, or by information, or by
That could be, and if you look at the facts of this case...
As a practical matter, I can't see, and honestly, I spent a good part of my life before I came up here in the criminal courts, prosecuting and defending and adjudicating, and I never was able to ascertain anything that would keep a prosecutor from doing precisely what happened in an adjacent district one time when the judge said, no, I'm not going to let you dismiss it. And Ed Stanley, who later was a district judge, stood up and said, all right, Your Honor, the United States rest as to that count. And the case was dismissed.
And as a practical matter, that may be, but that doesn't change the fact that the rule here required the court to perform the analysis. And it is clear that the court did not perform the analysis here because at the January 20 hearing, in response to the government's argument that, well, we didn't find any case law in point, but we would think that the court would have to afford our interpretation of whether the settlement is reasonable with deference, the court said yes, but that it would be blind deference because with the facts before me, I can't make a determination.
Judge Lambeth actually said, I'm not going to decide whether this is fair, just, and reasonable, whatever the language is.
In his decision, he did, but at the hearing...
At the hearing, too.
At the hearing, he basically said, I'll take it under consideration, but with the facts before me, I don't know how I would make a decision as to whether or not it's fair, adequate, and reasonable. Mm-hmm. And perhaps, as you're hinting
at... his ruling is controlled by Swift. He did not... He was not able to reconcile the two A and B subsections, and he saw his ruling as controlled by Swift. And if he were correct, if he was correct, then he would be correct that he didn't have to decide the fair and reasonableness, would he not? I'm not asking you to give up anything except the hypothetical that if he was correct on point A,
if Swift and or Hoyt controlled, then he would not have to undertake that analysis. But we think, as we've noted at length in our briefing, that is a stretch. That's an extension of this court's prior decisions. And quite frankly, it's at odds with public policy. It's the
You're
one part...
You're not going to win here on public policy, are
well,
you?
Well, the one part of the statute that's meant to protect the relator and keep the action going for the relator is a dead letter. I don't think that's what Congress intended.
I don't think you ought to use that phrase given the counsel who's going to stand up next.
Can I ask you a question about the retaliation
yes.
claim?
Yeah,
so,
let's move to that.
So help me to understand, under our precedent in Martin Baker, what was it that Ms. Schweitzer did that put Osei on notice that she had uncovered a violation of the False Claims Act?
Well, quite a bit.
Well, but I mean, under Martin Baker, aren't we supposed to ask whether her conduct was part of her ordinary obligations with her employment?
Is that
the test under Martin Baker?
Okay. Martin Baker and Yasudian, I think, both stand for the proposition that when it is your job to do this contract compliance, that there is a presumption, perhaps, that you need to show more just than you were just doing your job.
Mm-hmm.
And I think here there's ample evidence that Ms. Schweitzer...
So as a hypothetical, if I was hired by a government contractor and my job was to root out violations of the False Claims Act, and I found some and reported it to my supervisor, I couldn't then bring an action?
You actually could if your supervisor told you...
The company will destroy you.
Yeah, don't do anything about it.
I see.
And don't go to HR. Don't tell anyone else. Similarly, if you uncovered this fraud or this bad activity and you contacted Larry Allen at the Coalition...
So it wasn't going to Mr. Frost didn't provide the notice here. It was what she did after that? Is that
exactly.
Your
point? It was... disobeying the directive of Mr. Frost, and obviously there's a dispute in the record as to whether or not that happened.
No, but that's what...
right, but...
Your argument is no summary judgment to resolve
exactly.
that dispute. Right?
It was ignoring the directive of the supervisor, and I think the record here reflects from the deposition testimony of Osei's witnesses that Ms. Schweitzer wasn't just telling Mr. Frost, she was telling everybody. The company was a buzz, I think was the phrase that was used.
Was that how you put the company on notice, though? You talk about it at the water cooler?
I think it's one of the ways you can put a company on notice that this is a
But what you're supposed to be, it's in furtherance of an FCA action. So when you're talking at the water cooler, is that in furtherance of an FCA action? Is that the type of thing we're supposed to take notice of?
I think if you look at the totality of the circumstances here, there were certain acts that were directed, such as when Brian Beauchamp directed Ms. Schweitzer to go talk to HR.
Right, to HR and the inside-outside counsel. Those are all right. Pursuant to the company's order, so that doesn't count.
But that's not
right?
necessarily pursuant to the job description and her normal job function.
Well, I presume a part of the job description is that you obey the lawful directives of your superiors.
Right, and I guess...
So what is it here? If it can't be the water cooler chatter, that's not in furtherance of an FCA action. If it's not... if it can't be when she goes to speak to HR or the lawyers because her boss told her to do that, what is it?
I think it actually could be because, again, there's no evidence in the record that that's part of her normal job. And in fact...
Okay, well, if you were wrong on that, if I were to disagree with you on that and say, no, when your boss tells you to do something lawful, right. That's part of your job, then what is it?
When her immediate boss told her not to do something...
And then she goes to Beauchamp.
Right. And when her immediate boss told her not to do something lawful and
she
contacted people outside the company, the law of this circuit does not hold that you need to tell the company to lawyer up. It does not hold that you need to get a lawyer yourself, and it does not hold that you need to file an action.
And the statute doesn't say anything about that. I must admit that the law as it's developed here kind of baffles me. This seems to me simply a simple question of causation. Was the individual fired, demoted, or suffered an adverse action because of, on account of, the fact that they were pursuing or preparing this kind of a lawsuit, period? That seems to me a totally factual question. I don't understand this notice and all the other kind of stuff.
And I think it's... a good analogy would be to Title VII, where
was she preparing or acting pursuant to FCA action here when she goes to talk to Frost and Beauchamp? I actually like Judge Randolph's formulation. I agree. Seems to be more consistent with the statute than some of the things we've written. But was it further?
If I may interrupt, one of the problems here is that the statutory provision that you have printed in your addendum is the wrong one. You've got the 2010-11, whereas this is under the 2005. Your case is under they read very differently back then, because the one that you're under says simply in furtherance of an action to be brought or having been brought, which is very different than what it was amended to.
Sure, I apologize for that oversight. But again,
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, but what does in furtherance mean? Do I know what my client's mindset was at the time she was bringing this together? Do I know whether she would have filed a lawsuit had she not been terminated? I don't know, and the record doesn't speak to that.
So it's not a summary judgment question?
I don't think it is.
Yeah, and that's a different matter entirely.
And again, if you look to Title VII, which this court has looked, not this court, but courts have looked to, in the context of what is retaliation and what is protected activity, Title VII does not require you to file a charge.
Yeah, but because of would seem to imply that the company had to know, the employer had to know that the thing against which they're accused of retaliating had occurred.
Right, and I think...
Rather in defense of our case law, while notice may not be used in the statute, the because of element would seem to contemplate the company knowing about it in some fashion, the employer knowing about it in some fashion, whether we call it notice or...
And I think here that the company clearly knew about it as evidenced at...
What is it?
Of her actions.
Oh, famous American.
If we look at the joint appendix at pages 578 to 580, which is the termination letter my client was provided, it specifically noted that although we think your allegations are without basis, you might consider bringing them to the attention of the U.S. Inspector General. And we, the company, intend to report the claims. So why include that language if you didn't have notice that these were serious concerns and that Ms. Schweitzer might be considering.
Well, there's a difference in being serious concerns and being in furtherance of. Now, I don't have the language of the 2005 version because I didn't realize that you hadn't quoted the proper version. But, because of lawful acts done by the employer or employee on behalf of the employer, there's in furtherance of an action under this section. So you would still need to have knowledge under either version of the statute. Not that she had found serious violations, which would seem to be within her job, but that it was in furtherance of an action under this action, including investigation, initiation, testimony.
I think this court's Martin Baker decision made clear that it does not need to, the company does not need notice that the person actually might bring a lawsuit.
What would you say Martin Baker does stand for?
I think Martin Baker...
That inquiry started from Judge Griffith a while ago, and I'm not sure where it got to.
And I think where it got us was that had Ms. Schweitzer truly been following the chain of command...
No, forget about Ms. Schweitzer for a minute. Tell me what Martin Baker stands for.
Martin Baker stands for the proposition that if a reasonable person would think that these actions were, quote, in furtherance of an FCA action, then notice is appropriate.
Now, what is it here that would make the... Now, let's go back to Ms. Schweitzer, where you started a moment ago. What is it on your record before the district court, which is before us now, that would make us think that the company was on such notice or did have such knowledge?
Again, I think it was the conversations going over Mr. Beauchamp, going over Mr. Frost and disobeying his directive, and also the conversation that Ms. Schweitzer had with Larry Allen from the Coalition for Government Procurement, where Mr. Allen noted to both Ms. Schweitzer and Mr. Frost that these are illegal actions and you can go to jail.
Can I ask you, the Martin Baker decision was decided under a different provision on retaliation, right? And the amendment came that resulted in the 2005 provision came after Martin Baker's decision. Is there any indication of what Congress was doing? And it can be, the amendment can be read as tightening up the requirements for a retaliation suit. Because not only does it say what Judge Santel read, but before that it says, it defines in furtherance of an action to mean an investigation for bringing this type of action. Now, her investigation, was her investigation for the purpose of bringing an action, or was it in compliance with her duties as an employee?
I think arguably it was both.
Yeah. How should the company have known that it was anything other than her job?
Well, I guess if Martin Baker and Yasudians say that you don't need to actually say I'm going to sue you.
No, but on the record right here, what was the evidence from which this court could conclude that the company, that there is a substantial issue of material fact on the company's knowledge?
I think it's disobeying the directive of your supervisor and continuing to bring these issues up the chain. And again, as we note in our brief, if people like Ms. Schweitzer, who are charged with contract compliance, basically have to say, I'm going to sue you, necessarily they're going to be fired. So the point of this, and I think the legislative history and even this court's prior decisions note that the point of this provision, the retaliation provision, is to protect the relator. And we're not protecting the relator if we take a strict interpretation of the language. I think there has to be some flexibility.
This language is bizarre. I mean, on the one hand, it seems to me that it would be impossible to have a standalone retaliation claim like you can under Title VII, because if you never bring the KTAM action, then I don't know how you're, particularly a person whose job is to be a compliance officer, how they can say, well, you know, what I was doing was in contemplation of this, of an action that I never brought. I mean, I just don't see how that's possible. And let me ask you one other question. You said it may be both, and I think that's a fair answer. But if it is both, do we read this section as requiring a but-for cause, because of? In other words, if the employer has mixed motives, do you still have a retaliation claim?
That's an excellent question, and I think, again, I would have to analogize to Title VII.
If you analogize to Title VII, is it also the case that the employer, even if the employer in part, well, regardless, is there a burden-shifting regime here where the employer then has the opportunity to prove that the reason they fired the person was because she was just obnoxious?
I think that would be the case. I think it would be incumbent upon the employer. I don't know.
Are there any cases so holding? We've found none.
I'm not aware of any.
Yeah.
As I noted, this is a
open
case.
Open field, yeah.
It's a case that does present issues that have not been directly addressed.
Okay. We've, as is our custom, talked to you well past your time, but we'll give you back a couple of minutes.
Thank
for
you.
Rebuttal. We'll hear from the appellee. First of the appellees.
May it please the court, I'm Douglas Letter from the United States Department of Justice. Appearing here, we urge affirmance of the judgment with regard to counts one and two, as we've said, but I just want to emphasize we are not taking a position on the count three that the court was just directing to. Judge, let me just start out by saying, Judge Randolph, thank you. I've written down in my notes the first thing, I wish we would use a term other than dead letter. Nullity might be a more appropriate one. Thank you. Judge Griffith, if I could start with your question. You were saying what's the purpose of the hearing under C2A.
Right.
My brother counsel said it's nonsensical. I don't think it is, because what it does provide is a public opportunity. So it's not just a telephone call. It's a public opportunity for a relator to say to the and express in public before a court, the government is not properly carrying out the False Claims Act.
Isn't it a bit hard to argue that the purpose of a hearing is to persuade the other side, particularly if you're arguing in the same brief that the court has no role in the decision to be made by the other side?
Your Honor, you're absolutely right. It's an opportunity for them to try to persuade us. Clearly, by the time we get to court, the government has decided what it's going to do. As I say, I think instead it's to give the relator an opportunity and a forum to publicly say, we don't think the government is properly enforcing the False Claims Act, and here's why.
But now, you could say, if the court can't do anything about it, why is there such an opportunity?
I think it's consistent with the general purpose of the Act, which is to allow relators to move forward even if the government has chosen not to.
And do what if the government, without any leave of the court, can get rid of the case? How is that affording them a right to move forward?
The statute, you're right, Your Honor. I spoke not quite as specifically as I should. The statute gives relators a right to move forward if the government doesn't take over a case and if the government doesn't move to dismiss. What in under C2A, when the government says, no, this is one of those extremely rare cases when we want to end the litigation, it does give the relator this forum, and therefore it opens it to the public. It makes it clear to Congress so that if they choose to do something.
Although our precedent wouldn't allow us to do this, is it the best reading of it that what Congress was trying to do here was to protect the relator, both in instances of a dismissal and a settlement? And a hearing is to persuade a court. It's not like a broadside that you're posting in public, but we our precedent wouldn't allow us to go there.
I was just going to say, as Your Honor started your question, the precedent.
And I feel better about having said that.
having been the attorney in both Swift and Hoyt, I think this court has quite correctly interpreted the law in those binding decisions.
They were right to let you win in those cases, right?
So anyway, Your Honor, I hope that addresses your Judge Griffith, your question. Then my brother counsel said the government here could have in response to questions from the court, could have moved to intervened and dismissed. Well, that is what we did. We as the district court said, and in fact, as counsel in the district court, it's at page 61 of the appendix, said the government intervened. And
the motion was styled a motion to intervene, was
right. Yes. And the district court at page 51 of the appendix says we formally intervened. At page 61 of the joint appendix, counsel for the relator said we intervened. And so we did. If at that point we are supposed to have good cause, yes. And because it's not part of the automatic intervention right that is earlier in the case, in our view, it would clearly be good cause if the United States wants to intervene for the purpose of ending the litigation. But again, since
that was the alternative Haldeman Swift.
Yes, exactly, Your Honor. Exactly. And as this court pointed out in Swift, Your Honor writing for the court pointed out in Swift, it's sort of a silly argument to say the intervention here is inappropriate because the district court could itself sua sponte just to grant it. Your Honor, Judge Randolph, you asked, could the government under C2A dismiss a case and have a side agreement on a settlement? And the answer is yes. Now, we don't do that. Because in order to make the statute work, clearly this part of the statute depends on relators and relators coming forward. In fact, there are about, since the statute was significantly amended in 1986, there have been about 8,000 QI-TAM cases filed. The court records show this. And we intervene in only about 20% of those, a little more than 20%. So overwhelmingly, QI-TAM relators can and do move forward with their cases even if we don't intervene. We exercise C2A, a right to end the litigation, in just a handful of cases. So yes, we could shut down all QI-TAM cases. That's what C2A provides. We don't, and it would be totally inconsistent to make the statute work. And so that's why this is not, C2B is not a nullity. Because overwhelmingly, we don't use C2A. And therefore, if we use C2A all the time, we wouldn't get any relators. Why would somebody come forward if we were constantly?
You only intervene in 20% of the time. Is there any court requirement that any requirement that the court approve a settlement between the private party bringing the action and the defendant if the government is not in the case?
The case cannot be dismissed without the approval of the government.
But that.
So if the relator and there's been some litigation on this over the years, the Ninth Circuit opinion, Fifth Circuit opinion. So if the relator, let's say, the relator reaches a sweetheart deal with the defendant, and as part of that says, and in fact, the government's going to get nothing. We're going to get all of it. In our view, what the statute means, because the statute says the case cannot be dismissed without the approval of the Attorney General.
Veto, right?
Correct. Now, obviously, Your Honor, as the second...
There's no court approval, is there, required?
Well, the court would have to enter some sort of order saying dismissed.
I know. Does the court review the terms of the settlement agreement?
No, not that I'm aware of, unless, as Your Honor pointed out, you wanted to make the settlement part of some sort of judgment, then no, it would not. And so, and by the way, I think it's important to just give this little footnote. As the Second Circuit held, obviously the government doesn't have to approve if the court is dismissing the case on its merits. You know, if the court says, you know, we've had a trial, plaintiff, you're wrong, obviously the Attorney General doesn't need to approve there.
But every settlement agreement is going to result in the dismissal of the action, or at least the action not going forward. And so what you're advocating, as I hear it, is that whether you bring a settlement agreement to the attention of the court is totally up to the government's discretion, and that in every case we can dismiss it under subsection A.
That is correct, Your Honor. As I emphasized, we don't do that for a very good reason. But technically, could we? Yes, but we have the power to do that.
See,
but
that would I didn't read your brief as going that far. I thought your brief had a, at least as a fallback position, is that when you have something in the nature of, for example, a consent decree that I talked about, or something that the, will be incorporated into the judgment of the court, that then you have to comply with subsection B.
And Your Honor's right, and I didn't mean to sound inconsistent. Yes, we, as I understood the question, yes, we could dismiss, but if instead we want to make the settlement part of the court's judgment, then we do have to go to the court.
Let me follow up on that, because I've read the record to say that that's exactly what you sought. If you go to page 38 of the volume one of the well, it's sealed material. I don't know whether
This is not sealed, Your Honor. This part is not sealed.
Page 38, it says, the United States further requests, this is your motion, that the court retain jurisdiction to enforce the terms of the settlement agreement by and between the parties, determine the distribution, determine the award, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, you're making the settlement agreement part of the judgment of the court.
And, Your Honor, that is what we asked for. Remember, we argued in the district court there were two ways to end this litigation. One was C2A, and the other was we said C2B, and that's why we submitted all sorts of material to show that we had met C2B. Now, if we look at what the court actually did, the page, that's 58 and 59 of the appendix. I'll wait a moment.
Yeah. Okay.
I don't think the court's order actually does incorporate the settlement agreement into the order here. As I read it, the court retained jurisdiction to determine the relator's, Schweitzer's relator share and attorney fees. Those are provided for in the statute. 3730D1 so provides, and so the court retained jurisdiction as it would have under the statute. So Your Honor is right. We sort of lumped this together and we presented it to the district court as C2A and C2B, but I don't think what the court actually did, and therefore the judgment that we're urging you to affirm, incorporates
what
the settlement.
What would happen if the defendant, after you reach the settlement agreement and the court issued a dismissal, and the defendant doesn't cough the money up?
I think then, if it's not part of the judgment of the decree, we would have to seek other remedies, or remedies to enforce a contract, common law remedies is what we would have to do, I believe.
It would be pretty clear. You go back to court and say that this is a, you know, did you dismiss this action in contemplation of the payment of some certain, we're seeking, and the way these things go, at least in my experience, was first thing you seek is a specific injunction, and then you seek contempt, and there's usually a two-step process.
Right, and that's what the Kokanen case, the Supreme Court decision that we discussed, that's what was going on there.
Yeah.
As I say, I think there would be alternative possibilities. I have covered what I had in my notes. If the court has other questions, I'm happy to.
If the court has further questions, then we'll hear from the other appellate.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Lutter. Breckenridge.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Tillman Breckenridge on behalf of the OSA entities. I wanted to start out by first addressing Judge Randolph's question regarding where he stated that he didn't understand the need for notice for retaliation claim. And I think Judge Sintel.
Actually, that's not my point. My point is that this is being treated as if it's some kind of statutory requirement, when in fact all we have is a simple causation problem. Was the person fired because of certain activity led to the filing of a complaint? I mean, that seems to me a rather simple question. And notice, non-notice, it's not all clear to me that it's any more complicated than what I just said. So.
Oh, I agree. I think the notice issue is just derivative of the words because of.
Part of.
Yeah. Yes. And
you have to know before it can be because of it. The actor has to be aware of it, right?
Exactly, Your Honor.
Okay.
And to hear counsel for Schweitzer put it, it really comes down to a couple of things for them.
May I interrupt you? But see, I don't know. I think that just pushes the problem back. You have to be aware of it. What is it that you have to be aware of? The person doing the investigation may not, at the very moment they're uncovering the fraud, be thinking in terms of bringing a lawsuit. They may be thinking of uncovering the fraud, period. And only later, after contemplating the thing, does the idea ripen that they're going to bring a lawsuit. Now, in that situation, what they're doing is certainly in furtherance of the ultimate lawsuit that's brought. But it wasn't on their mind at the time, and if they're fired for that, why isn't that within the terms of the statute as existed in 2005?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, under either statute, it is in furtherance of if that is not part of the person's job description, for instance, which you had in Ucidian. And what you have in this case, though, and in Martin Baker, is that it's part of the person's job description. And so the fact that that someone conducts an investigation, and by the way, we do not concede that what Ms. Schweitzer did was an investigation in furtherance of a False Claims Act action. But if the person does engage in an investigation in furtherance of a False Claims Act action, or rather an investigation as a compliance officer, then as far as notice to the company is concerned and the basic knowledge needed to retaliate, the company can't know that the person is actually acting in furtherance of a False Claims Act action unless there is some other sign. So, for instance,
it says, because of activity in furtherance of a claim to be filed or filed, and the situation you just described, even though it's part of their job description, is still in furtherance of a claim to be filed, isn't it? It's not against it. It's not peripheral. It's in furtherance of. If that's the very information that serves as the basis for the complaint, why wasn't it in furtherance of?
Well, I would disagree that it's actually in furtherance of an action as opposed to in furtherance of finding out facts of noncompliance.
I mean, that's what counsel for the plaintiff or for the realtor said, I think rather candidly, that, you know, it can be both.
Well, and under certain circumstances, I suppose it could be both, depending on the statute at the time, and depending on also the whether or not the relator. It can be both if the relator perhaps understands that there might be some sort of action against the company that person is pursuing. It doesn't necessarily have to be a False Claims Act action.
Some real silly hypotheticals where the individual who's the compliance officer does a fraud investigation and then knocks on her supervisor's door and says, hey, listen, I want to tell you, from here on out, I'm doing this, but I'm not doing it because it's my job. I'm doing it because I'm going to nail you with a lawsuit. Then it will be okay.
Well, Your Honor, I would say that I think that the question is coming from an area that we should...
If they're fired.
Your Honor?
If they're fired, then they have a retaliatory action.
But I don't think we should be addressing this in the terms of what someone should be doing to set up a retaliation action, I guess, is my response to that. As the relator stated in her reply brief, the idea under the False Claims Act is to actually keep this stuff a secret. And so the retaliation provision isn't intended to be an instruction for a potential relator to go running around her company and telling everyone that she's pursuing a False Claims Act action. It is for the unfortunate circumstance of when that secret becomes public, becomes known to the company, and then that company retaliates based on the secret. And so the idea of giving a potential relator an instruction to go to their supervisor and say, I'm not doing this as part of my job, I'm doing this as part of a False Claims Act investigation, would be contrary to the intent of the statute as stated by the relator. And so, especially in this case, it is a perfect example of that. What it comes down to here is Schweitzer's claim that, first of all, she went to Larry Allen, who was part of the Coalition for Government Procurement. And there's one thing on the, I'd like to correct on the record about that. She did not do that on her own initiative. Based on her own deposition testimony, which is at JA 565, the question is, who is Larry Allen other than a very good friend of yours? And the response is, he's a president of the Coalition of Government Procurement, and then it goes on a little bit. And then she says, after this conversation where Mr. Frost calls Larry Allen, her supervisor called Larry Allen calls me and I spoke to him. So by her own deposition testimony, she's saying Larry Allen actually called her at the request of Mr. Frost. And that goes back to what Judge Griffith was saying at the beginning of the discussion about retaliation, which is there's an, and actually what the district court stated in its opinion, which is there's nothing here that's not part of her normal job responsibilities.
Well, her interaction with Mr. Frost doesn't seem to be part of a normal job responsibility, right? She brings this to his attention, and then by her allegations, he claims that she needs to stop looking into this, that the company will destroy you. Everyone knows that they've been manufacturing in China for a while. That doesn't seem to be part of a normal job responsibility. I mean, if it's normal, he'd say, oh, thank you for bringing this to my attention. We'll do something about it. But that's not what she claims happened here.
Yeah, well,
isn't there a dispute about something? There's a dispute about something that's material.
Taking that allegation is true.
Which we must.
Yes. I would say that that might, if she had actually not said anything as a result of what Mr. Frost told her, that would not have been part of her normal job responsibilities. Her normal job responsibilities included reporting to Mr. Beauchamp, which is what she supposed, which is what she says she did after Mr. Frost told her not to pursue it any further. And that admission is on page JA 185, where she says as part of her job of bringing GSA contracts into compliance, she would be investigating where every product on the contracts was manufactured and notifying Brian Beauchamp and Ron Frost of the ways in which these contracts
were. When the company terminated her, one of the grounds was that she went outside the chain of command. Isn't that referring to her going around Frost to Beauchamp?
No, Your Honor, that's not what
what's
it's
that
about.
Referring to?
It's about her going around, I believe it was going around. Or actually it was not going around, going to Ron Frost with issues with Lee Metzger and things like that when she was having, and then it's a disputed fact as to whether or not they were screaming matches or not screaming matches, right. But at the same time it's agreed upon that they were, that there was conflict between her and Lee Metzger and her and Kathy Carey. And so that there was a chain of command issue there that's expressed in Ron Frost's emails to her. And that she wasn't going through the proper chain of command by going to Ron Frost with this stuff instead of confronting Lee Metzger.
Is an element of a retaliation claim that the ultimate QITEM action that's brought have merit?
No, it's not, Your Honor.
Why not? If you fire somebody, what they're doing is snooping around, making all kinds of allegations of fraud, saying to everybody, I'm doing this for you, to bring one of these suits because I can get a lot of money out of it, and then they bring the suit and a judge kicks it out as totally frivolous, and in the interim you fire them for that kind of conduct. Why should they be entitled to a retaliation claim?
Oh, I agree with you, Your Honor, to the extent that you're talking about something that's frivolous, like here or like in Lucky. When you said has merit, I thought you were referring to something that might be on the border, but then ultimately it's decided that
it's
a False Claims Act violation there.
My definition of non-frivolous is it has merit.
Okay, fair enough. But yeah, so then I agree with you. I do think that when it's a frivolous allegation of a False Claims Act violation, the company should be able to fire the person, just as was stated in Lucky about not being able to engage in saber rattling just to save your job after there's a problem, which, according to the timeline here, is exactly what happened. And there is a recent case out of the...
Well, this one had some merit, didn't it, at least by... if one judges by the settlement.
It settled for $1.2 million.
Your Honor, I wouldn't say that, because the claim was asserted as being worth $165 million and more. And so we're talking about less than 1% of the asserted claim, which if you're facing that kind of situation, any litigation...
You're not going to have us ask Mr. Lutter if the government paid $1.2 million to settle a claim that had no merit, are you?
I'm sorry,
you wouldn't like to hear Mr. Lutter answer the question, did the government pay $1.2 million to settle a claim that had no merit?
Oh, I'm not sure. You mean receive $1.2 million to settle
the government
that had no merit?
Receive, rather, yeah.
Yeah.
Receive $1.2
million. Well, I presume that the government's position
I'm
is
sorry,
that
I
had some merit at some point.
The government received $1.2 million for
yes.
that had no merit.
At least at some point, the government thought that there was merit to the case. I can't speak for the government right now.
Now, how about you, your company? Did they want to pay $1.2 million to settle something that had no merit?
If it means not getting into litigation that has an opportunity of losing $165 million,
if it has no merit, is there an opportunity to lose $155 million?
Well, with respect to the judicial system, Your Honor, sometimes things go awry, and when that's less than, then there's always a 1% chance.
The government got an unjust enrichment of $1.2 million. Your company paid $1.2 million for a totally meritless claim.
Well, in the position of OSE, there was not merit to the claim.
So you've just announced to the world, sue OSE. We'll settle.
Provided you sue for $155 million.
That's right. Go big.
Well, and beyond that, unless the court has any further questions, I believe I can submit.
Probably exhausted our questions for you. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Now, we had used up your time, counsel. We'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honor, I will save everybody's time and let everybody not have to deal with me again.
We always appreciate that, counsel. Well, no, we usually appreciate that. Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted. Give us recess.